stronger.
We both emerged, I said, modifying his words. I was never sure I understood what Riegel's torture had done to me. Part of me had died in that cell, both literally and figuratively. I was alive today. I'd never know if I'd lost more than what I had found. Useless to wonder. What else? I demanded. His head lolled forward slightly, and then twitched up. I changed my question. How long have you been awake?
I don't know. I doze off and then wake, and I don't know how long I've been asleep. Blindness is peculiar, Fitz. No day, no night, and not darkness, if you want to know.
Any other dreams or thoughts you want to share with me?
I dream of a nut that is dangerous to crack. Sometimes I hear a nonsense ditty. The trap is the trapper, and the trapper is trapped. But it isn't always dreams. Sometimes I see like a crossroads, but one with an infinite number of paths starring away from a center. When I was a youngster, I saw those often and clearly. After you brought me back to life, I didn't see any for a long time. Not until B touched me in the market that day. That was incredible. I touched her, and I knew she was the center of a multitude of paths. She saw them, too. I had to draw her back from making too swift a choice.
His voice faltered to a stop. Then what happened? I demanded in consternation. He gave a snort of laughter.
Then I believe you knifed me in the belly. A number of times. But I lost count after two.
Oh. Cold roiled through me. I wasn't sure you recalled any of that. I felt the weight of his body against my shoulder. I'm sorry, I said.
It's too late for that.
He patted me with his gloved hand and straightened up with a sigh.
I've already forgiven you.
What can one say to that? He continued,
Paragon. When I looked up at Paragon as we came into dock at Treehog, he was shining with pathways. There were others there, at that junction, leading back to Kelsingra or into Treehog itself. But most of the ones that led to Clarez, the straightest, shortest ones, began with Paragon.
So that was why you insisted we must stay with him?
Now you believe in me?
I don't want to, but I do.
I feel the same.
Silence claimed us both. I waited. After a time, I realized he was deeply asleep. I moved him gently from my shoulder onto the bunk. I lifted his legs up onto the bed. It reminded me of how I used to put Hap back to bed after his nightmares, all those years ago. The fool pulled his knees in closer to his chest and slept, curled defensively. I sat down again on the edge of the bunk. He would sleep, and he would dream, whether he wished or no. And I would skill. I exhaled slowly, letting my breath blow away my boundaries, and immediately became more aware of the ship. Excuse me, I muttered, as if I had bumped against a stranger in a crowd. Then I ignored his presence and reached out, feeling for the skill current. It was there, but it was calmer than I'd felt it in months. It was as constant as the wind that gently filled the sails and pushed us through the waves. I moved with the skill current, letting it carry my thoughts and will toward Buckkeep and to my daughter, Nettle. She was sleeping. I eased into her dream thoughts, woke her gently. How are you and your child? Shade's dead. The news flew from her mind to mine, drenching me with her urgency that I know. Her grief swept in and woke my as-yet unformed sorrow. For a time, that was all there was. I did not ask her how. He was old. It had been coming for a very long time, deprived of the herbs and kept from the skill that he had been using for so long to rejuvenate himself. His years had caught up to him.
I blame myself. We gave him Delvenbach to quench his skill. He had grown so randomly strong with it. He would be calm, and then he was like a cold wind blasting. Two of the new apprentices decided to leave the training because his spells were so frightening. Even Shine had come to dread his moments of strength, for no matter how she deadened herself, he would seize her and tumble her into the skill with him. She was terrified, as were we all. So I authorized the Delvenbach. I changed all the pages who had been carrying out his errands. I suspect they were fetching more than food and wine for him. After 3 days of it, it blocked his skill, and he became an old man, kindly but fretful and old. We let him have visits with Shine again. I'd had to keep her away from him. He didn't seem to understand why we had kept his daughter away. He was so confused. He would talk to Shrewd's portrait. Oh, Fitz, I fear he died thinking I was needlessly cruel, that I had taken his daughter and his magic from him, simply for meanness, simply to control him.
I felt Riddle. He'd heard her crying, I surmised, and woken. I felt him as if he were armor closing around her, hammered metal, holding her in and upright. Anything that wanted to hurt her would have to go through him first. I thought grief had numbed me, but suddenly relief soared in my heart. I am glad Riddle is there with you.
So am I. I'll tell him that.
Did you get our bird messages?
Yes. Shade's message from Lant was clutched in his hand. I don't know how many times Shine read it aloud to him. Fitz, he was smiling when we found him. A calm, sweet smile.
I realized abruptly, I have to tell Lant. Then,
I can't. Your first thought was correct. You must tell him, as I had to tell you.
I will. I didn't know how or when, but I would tell him. And Spark. I wondered if I now understood the fool's compulsion to speak of his dreams. I did not want to tell them, yet I desperately wanted to share the news, as if grief were a heavy burden to be spread out among those who must bear it.
Yes,
she agreed,
and it's good to know you are alive. I have reached out to you over and over these last few days. When none of us could reach you with the skill, we feared the worst.
I'm on a live ship. His presence is pervasive. Even as I skilled to her, I could feel the ship sharing what I told her. I am sorry to have worried you.
I understand. I will immediately wake Dutiful to tell him.
Then my own news burst from me without warning. The fool has dreamed that B is alive. And the last time I could reach you with the skill, when Shade so abruptly parted us, I felt B. I knew her touch. The winds of all the worlds blew between us, and the shushing of waves whispered against every shore. What news was more shocking, that Shade had died, or B might still live? I felt her shock pour through me.
Where is she? How is she? Have they mistreated her? Does she think we abandoned her? How did she survive passing through that skill stone? How is it possible she lived and we gave up on her for months?
I don't know. That was the torment of it. So much I didn't know. I was not going to tell my pregnant daughter that her small sister was miserable and mistreated. That I would lie about with a clear conscience. I agonized enough for the both of us. I would not put that burden on her. I just had a brush of her against my senses. I know she is bound for Clarys, as are we. I do not know if she is ahead of us or behind us. Only that she is on a ship bound for Clarys. That was all, and the fool dreamed of her, alive. It's little to go on, but I will take heart from it. Her thoughts suddenly swept over me, a mistress of war woken.
I will muster an army of warriors and skill users. Eliania has brought up this proposal more than once to me. We will come. We will take back what is ours and leave nothing but ruins and bodies.
No. For now, do not send any vast force in this direction. We think our best chance is to go in quietly.
You will negotiate for her return?
That thought had never even occurred to me. I had set out on a mission of vengeance, planning only to kill. The thought of B in their hands had only made me more determined to see their blood. I am still on a ship, bound for Clarice. I will decide when I arrive there and study the situation. Perhaps I shall negotiate. There were many ways to negotiate. Taking hostages immediately sprang to mind. My thoughts went winging off, and I knew that Nettle sensed that.
How are you?
I asked her.
Heavy. Tired. Happy. Sometimes.
Sometimes. When she was thinking of her baby, rather than the death of Shade, or the torment of her small sister.
I'm sorry I woke you, and sorry that Shade is gone. I will tell Lant, and you should rest now.
She laughed.
Rest, while thinking of little Bee in the hands of kidnappers. Oh, Da, does life ever become simple?
Only for a few moments, my dear. Only for a few moments. I drew myself away from her as if we were unclasping hands. For a time longer, I floated in the skill. I wondered if some remnant of Shade remained in this flow, some ghost of Verity, or perhaps even my father. I had encountered presences in the skill. I was not sure what they were, only that they were far larger beings than I was.
Larger?
Richer. Deeper. More fully formed. Ida and El? Ancient elderlings, or skill users who had acquired more presence in that flow. I gathered my courage.
Bee, can you hear me?
I formed an image of my little girl in my mind. Little Bee. I saw her in her old-fashioned clothing. I saw her doubting gaze as she looked up at me. I smelled the fading scent of honeysuckle on a warm summer night. Then I saw all the ways I had failed her. No, this was not helping. I'd never find her that way. I pushed aside reluctance and tried to reconstruct that moment of contact we'd had. With Shade rushing down on us like a summer squall on a small boat, pushing and scattering and threatening.
Fitz, my boy!
An echo in the vast current of skill, a brief recollection of Shade like a perfume on a spring breeze. Dead. Gone. The flood of loss was too much. I tried again to reach for B, but I was groping in dark water. My child was as gone as Shade was. I drew back from the skill current and opened my eyes to the darkness of the fool's chamber. He was sleeping deeply. There was no one else in the room. Sitting on the floor, I pulled my knees up tight to my chest and bowed my head over them. Shade's boy wept. Chapter 23. Clarice. The unexpected sun arrives cloaked in a power that none can see but all can feel. It shimmers and floats and confuses both eye and mind. In my dream, he is one, then two, then three creatures. He opens his cloak and fury burns inside him, flames that make me fall back before their heat. He closes his cloak, and he is gone. An unexpected sun has appeared in various guises and has been dreamed 124 times. In the last 30 years, it has been dreamed 70 times. In every case, the dreamer reported a sense of foreboding. One described it as the cringing servant who expects punishment. Another reported a sense of shame before justice. I have dreamed my own form of the dream of the unexpected sun. I believe it is a dream of justice and punishment to come, brought to those who least expect it. And I have dreamed it more than a dozen times. I believe this dream is an inevitable future. I have studied other dreams of the sun, attempting to find from whence he comes and to whom he brings judgment. In none of the dreams can I find this information.
Dream 729 of Della, of the Corathin lineage.
Clarys was the strangest place I had ever seen. I stood on the deck, forgetful of my errand for Dwalia, and stared. Ahead of me was a kindly harbour with water that was impossibly blue. All around the harbour there were square buildings of pink and white and pale green, with flat roofs and numerous windows. Some of the buildings had small pointed tents pitched on their roofs. Greenery cascaded down the sides of some, framing the windows. Behind the buildings that fronted the harbour, the gentle rolling hills beckoned in shades of gold and brown. There were random solitary trees with fat trunks and widespread branches, although on one hillside, even ranks of trees might have been an orchard. The distant hills were speckled with herds of grazing animals. The white and grey ones were probably sheep. The other herd creatures were cattle, of a sort I had never seen, with branching horns and hummocks on their shoulders. The small boats of our ship had been deployed and our sails furled. Bare-chested sailors bent their backs to the oars as they towed us toward the docks. Slowly, so slowly, we drew closer to shore. The terraced city followed a curve of land that embraced the harbour. One arm of the embrace was a long, narrow peninsula, but the peninsula was broken. Beyond that gap, as if it had broken off from the land, was a big island with a dazzling ivory fortress upon it. The island itself was also white, almost blindingly so. Its lumpy shores of tumbled blocks of stone sparkled. Quartz. I'd once found a rock that sparkled like that, and Revel had told me it had quartz in it. All the land outside the fortress walls was barren. Not a tree, no trace of green. It looked to me as if it were an island that had suddenly popped up out of the sea with a magical castle atop it. The outer walls of the castle were tall and crenellated. At each corner a staunch guard tower rose, each topped with a structure like the skull of some immense and fearsome creature. Each of the empty-eyed skulls stared off in a different direction. Within the stone walls, and taller than the walls, a sturdy stronghouse stood, and four slender towers rose from each corner of that, the spires even taller than the castle towers, with bulbous rooms at the top, like the top of an onion left to go to seed. Never had I seen towers so tall and slender, gleaming pale against the blue sky. I stared at it, my destination, my future. Despair tried to rise in me. I pushed it down with frozen stones. I didn't care. I was alone. I would be enough for me. I'd had two dreams since my father had cast me aside. Two dreams that I dared not think about for fear that Vindelire might glimpse them. They had frightened me. Badly. I had woken in the dark of night and stuffed the front of my shirt into my mouth so no one could hear me sobbing. But when I calmed, I understood. I could not see my path clearly, but I knew I had to walk it alone. To Clarys. I had been sent out of Dwalia's stateroom to return a tray of dirty dishes to the galley. Usually she did not choose me for such tasks. I think she intended it as yet another demonstration to Vindelire that I was not only trusted, but quickly becoming her favourite. I had perfected my grovelling servitude and taken it to levels he dared not approach. I radiated repentant loyalty at her in a small, steady stream. It was dangerous, for it meant I must constantly be on my guard against Vindelire, lest he gain entry to my mind. He had grown terribly strong since he had drunk the serpent spit. But he was strong as a bullock was strong, good at large motions and breaking walls. I was not a wall. I was a tiny rolling pebble, hard as a nut, with no edges for him to grasp. I'd felt him try more than once. I had to keep myself very small and let out only the thoughts that had no real ties to me, like my slavish admiration of Dwalia. I'd carried my pretense well, even to standing by her bath and holding a towel for her, and then stooping to dry her calloused feet and lumpy toes. I'd rub her feet to hear her groan with pleasure, and I'd set out her clothing as if I were garbing royalty rather than draping a hateful old woman. My ability to deceive her almost frightened me, for it involved thinking the thoughts of a defeated slave. Sometimes I feared that those thoughts were becoming my true thoughts. I did not want to be her slave, but living without the threats and the beatings was such a relief that it was almost an acceptance that this was the best life I could hope for. I felt a familiar squeezing in what I thought must be my heart. I had heard of being heartbroken or heavy-hearted, but I had never known it was an actual sensation one felt when the whole world abandons you. I looked out at what I knew must be Clara's and tried to believe I could make a life for myself there, for I knew now I would never go home. I had felt my father's touch upon my mind. I had felt him spurn me, cast me aside so violently that I had woken, shaking and sick. I had reached for Wolffather. He had not understood it any better than I had. So, it was done. I was alone. No one was ever going to come and rescue me. No one cared what had become of me. I had known that for days now, but even more I had known it for every long night that came between those days. During the days when both Dwalia and Vindelire were awake, I had no time to dwell on it. I was too busy defending my thoughts from Vindelire while grovelling to Dwalia and impressing on her how cowed and subservient I was now. During those hours, my father's abandonment was a constant humming pain, as permanent as the restless water that surrounded us. During the days, my survival floated on that sea of hurt. At night, I sank beneath it and drowned in it. My loneliness had become absolute when I had touched minds with my father and he had pushed me away. I had tried to make it less of a rejection in any way I could, but it was like trying to put the pieces of a cup together so it made a teapot. There had been those other voices. One had been my sister's, perhaps, but I was not certain. There had been a chorus of others, including one who shouted and roared. I didn't know how I had reached them, but I knew my father had been aware of me. "Flee," he had bidden me, as if there were danger, but he did not flee with me. He had not caught me up and kept me safe. He had stayed in the middle of that storm of voices. He had paid attention to them, pushing me to one side. When I had dared to call out to him again, he had shoved me roughly away. He had pushed me so hard that I had not been able to hold on to him. I'd fallen away from him, away from my hope of rescue and a return to a life that had some kindness in it. I'd tumbled back into myself, into my lonely, small self, and found Vindelire already sniffing around my boundaries. I had not even dared to weep aloud. I'd slammed my walls tight, tight, tight. Wolffather had warned me. To hold my walls that tight meant no one could reach me. At that moment, I hoped no one would ever touch my thoughts again. I never wanted anyone to like me again, let alone love me. And I was never, ever going to like anyone else. The pain in my heart had suddenly become a pain in my belly. It combined with the hurt of holding the dreams unspoken and unwritten. But the dreams that came to me now, I dared not speak. They were frightening and tantalizing, tempting and terrifying. They called to me to make them real. And with every day of our journey, they became more real to me, as if I came ever closer to an inevitable future I would make. I closed my eyes for a moment and then opened them to the pastel city before me. I made myself see how pretty it was, and I imagined myself as a happy person there. I would trot along those streets, greeting the people I knew, running some useful errand for Dwalia, and some day I would escape. No, I could not have that thought, nor that plan. Not yet. It was a lovely place, a wonderful place to call home. How happy I was to be here.
I trickled out a bit of that thought. I had discovered that I could feed such things to Dwalia even when I couldn't see her. Her mind was a shape I knew now, as was Vindelire's. Experimentally, I dribbled a bit of my imaginary happiness onto him. For a moment, I felt him warm, and then he slapped my thought away. He did not know how to make his thoughts reach me clearly. Sometimes they did, but I think that was something that happened, rather than something he knew how to do. I did not hear his direct thoughts, but I felt his distrust of me. And behind his distrust, his hurt. Somehow, he had truly believed that I would become his brother and love him as no one else ever had. He had seen a path for us that I never had. For a moment, the stinging thought that perhaps he felt as abandoned as I did shamed me. Then I crushed it down and shut it out of my mind. No. He had helped to kidnap me, had aided in destroying my home, and had tricked and helped kill the only person who had befriended me on my horrible journey. He had no right to think anyone would love him for doing those things. But fury was a strong emotion, and I was learning that strong emotions made cracks in my wall. I denied my hatred. It made my stomach hurt worse than ever. But I did it. I turned my eyes to the pretty city with the little rectangular houses like little cakes displayed on a shelf. I would have a delicious life here. I put a cheery smile on my face and carried my tray to the galley and left it there. As I made my way back to the captain's stateroom, I had to dodge hurrying sailors. As we neared our destination, the number and pace of their tasks were increasing. One of them cursed at me as I skipped out of his way. Small boats were hastening toward us as our sailors secured the gathered sails. Coiled lines awaited. The little boat would tow us into the docks. Our arrival was imminent. I tapped on the stateroom door in case the captain was making a last-minute visit and heard Dwalia's charming request that I should enter.
"Pack it all up,"
she commanded me as soon as she saw me. She gestured at the scattered garments that she had tried on and then discarded. Every time we had stopped in a port, the captain had purchased more garments for her. I wondered what she would do with them all once we disembarked and she was no longer Lady Obricia. She herself was occupied with carefully setting the jewelry she had acquired onto a finely woven scarf, also gifts from her captain. Once she had them arranged, she rolled the scarf up, folding the ends in as she went, and then tying it into a small bundle. By then, I was nearly finished layering her gauzy and lacy finery into a trunk. "Will you be sad to leave him?" The question had popped into my head and out of my mouth. At her sudden scowl, I hastily added, "He treats you so well, it must be gratifying to have someone recognize your true value." She narrowed her eyes at me. It had been a bit too complimentary, but I made my querying face as bland as possible and then turned away to finish fastening the buckles of the trunk. I managed a sideways glance at Vindelire. He was very slow gathering his meager possessions and stuffing them into a worn bag. Since I had become Dwalia's favorite, she had asked less and less of him. I had imagined he might be grateful to have fewer tasks, but her ignoring of him only fueled his dislike of me. I had the uneasy feeling that he was planning something. But if he was, he had kept it well concealed. I, too, had a plan, one that was slowly taking shape in my mind. I dared not dwell on it, lest he catch some flavor of it in my thoughts. It was the first plan that I should have made, back in winter when they had first captured me. No, don't think about it in front of them when they are awake. I reminded myself again of the little pastel houses and what an agreeable life awaited me in this pretty city. Dwalia responded at last.
"I shall be sad to leave him."
Then she took a deep breath and squared her shoulders.
"But this is not my life. I do not depend on a man's position and affection to claim what should be mine."
She sounded almost angry that she had been well treated by him. She turned to Vindelire.
"You remember what you are to do as we disembark?"
"Yes."
His agreement was sullen. She cocked her head slightly at him.
"And you are certain you can do it?"
"Yes."
His eyes flickered to me, and I knew a moment of unease.
Fine.
She stood, straightened her dress and patted at her hair. I had braided it for her that morning and coiled it carefully at the back of her head. Now she smoothed it, as if she were the lovely woman the captain imagined her to be. Sparkling earrings dangled, and a network of silver rings dotted with tiny sparkling jewels caged her throat. But above it was her plain, round face, ruined forever by the scar my teeth had left. From what I had read in my father's scrolls, I suspected that Farseer skill magic could repair her face, but I did not tell her that. It might be a negotiating chip I would need later, an offer that might keep me alive, or at least make her curious enough to let me live a bit longer. I tried to recall how kindly she had seemed the first time I met her, how motherly and solicitous. Vindalaya's magic. Vindalaya dared a question.
Do they know we are returning, Simph and Felody?
She was silent, and I thought she would not reply. Then she said,
Sending short bird messages would just have confused them. I will explain myself when I stand before them.
He took in a little breath, as if that frightened him.
They will be surprised to see we are alone.
Alone? She snapped. We bring with us the prize I said we would gain, the unexpected sun.
Vindalaya slid his eyes sideways to look at me. We both knew she no longer believed that. I thought he would have the sense to be quiet, but instead he said,
But you know B's a girl.
She bawled a fist at him.
That doesn't matter. Stop talking about things you are too stupid to understand. I will handle this. I will deal with all of it. You will tell no one she is a girl. You will not speak at all. Do you understand me? That should not be too difficult for your feeble mind. Just don't talk.
He parted his lips, then nodded dumbly and emphatically. Dwalia went to the window and stared out at the endless blue sea. Did she wish she was not going home? In the few extra minutes in which Dwalia did not busy me, I did my best to smooth my hair. I managed to dabble my hands in her used washwater and wipe my face with the cloth before I bore it away. Wear had not improved my garments, but they were reasonably clean. I made a sack out of my worst shirt and put my few spare garments inside it. I tied the sleeves together to make a handle and slung it over my shoulder. I had chosen my disguise. I would be an honest child, standing straight before all, harmless and intent on pleasing Dwalia. Let no one fear or suspect what I truly was. We heard the shouts of the sailors and the noises of the town had grown louder. The little boats would tow us right up to the docks that fingered out from the busy streets. Between us, Vindalaya and I managed to carry the trunk full of Dwalia's fine garments up to the deck. Dwalia tucked the packet of jewelry into a lovely embroidered bag that she carried, and there on the deck we stood, mostly out of the sailor's way, and waited for the ship to reach the dock and be safely moored to it, and then for the gangplank to be put into place. Only then did the captain come to us. He took both Dwalia's hands in his, kissed her chastely on her cheek, and told her that he had already sent a runner ahead to secure lodgings for her in a clean and honest inn. Regretfully, he said, he could not accompany us, but he had two strong men who would carry her trunk and escort her to the place. He promised that he would come with her to Clary's castle to consult on her future, for he hoped he would figure large in such a reading. Lady Obricia simpered and thanked him. The elegant arched plumes on her hat bobbed in the sea breeze. She reminded him that she had business of her own to conduct in Clary's, but she would see him that evening, and her two servants could manage to take her trunk to the lodgings, so no escort was needed. For a moment, his brow was wrinkled in concern for his darling. Then the lines smoothed as I felt Vindalaya manipulate his mind. Of course she would be fine. He would not worry for her. She was as competent as she was lovely, and he cherished her independent spirit. Even so, he accompanied us down the gangplank. He again took Dwalia's hands in his and looked down at her as she tilted her head back to meet his fond gaze.
"Be careful, my lovely," he cautioned her, and stooped to take a final kiss.
I felt Vindelire do it. He dropped the illusion as the captain's face neared hers and let him see her as she was. His intended kiss did not reach her mouth as he recoiled from her. In less than a breath, Vindelire had restored her glamour. But by then the captain had stumbled back a step. He blinked, rubbed his eyes with the palms of both his hands, and then smiled at Dwalia sheepishly.
"I've been awake too long. I stand on land and feel giddy from the stillness. Lady Obricia, I will see you later this evening. We shall dine together."
"We shall," she promised him faintly.
He turned his head, rubbed his brow, and made his way back up to his ship. He looked back at us from the deck of his ship, and she lifted a lace-gloved hand to wave at him. He grinned like a boy, waved back, and turned to his duties. For a moment longer, she stood staring after him. Hurt made her homely face even plainer. Vindelire stood innocently by, feigning that he did not know what had just happened, but...
"He saw me,"
Dwalia said in a low, accusing voice.
"You allowed him to see me."
Vindelire looked off into the distance.
"Perhaps for an instant my control faltered."
He shifted his gaze back to her, and then away. I saw his vicious satisfaction, but perhaps it was too fleeting for her to catch.
"It takes a great deal of strength to maintain such an illusion,"
he pointed out to her.
"The captain is not a gullible man. To make his crew see you as Lady Obricia was hard. To make the captain see you in such a different form, in every moment he was with you, has near drained my magic. Perhaps now is the time when you should give me..."
"Not here,"
she snapped. She glared at both of us.
"Pick up that trunk and follow me."
Vindelire took one end, and I seized the other handle, and we walked behind her. The trunk was not that heavy. Carrying it was only awkward because Vindelire was such a weakling. He kept shifting his grip from hand to hand, and he walked leaning over as if he could barely lift it. The trunk bumped and skipped on the paving stones and knocked against my hip and calf. Every 100 paces or so, Dwalia had to stop and wait for us to catch up with her. Vindelire strove to maintain her appearance. Men were halting to cast admiring looks at her. Two women exclaimed to each other over her hat and dress. She walked proudly, and when she glanced back at us, there was a pleased light in her eyes I had never seen before. We walked down streets crowded with folk foreign to my eyes. Sailors and merchants and workers, I guessed them to be, but in all manner of garb and of all different colourings. I saw a boy with hair as red as rust, his hands and arms speckled with freckles, like a bird's egg. There was a woman taller than any person I'd ever glimpsed, and her bare brown arms were sheathed all over in white tattoos, from her fingertips to her wide shoulders. A bald little girl in a pink frock skipped beside her equally bald mother, whose lips were framed with tiny jewels. I turned my head, wondering how the jewels stayed on, and the trunk hit my calf on top of an earlier bruise. I felt Vindelire struggling to carry the trunk and maintain Lady Obricia's illusion. The third time Dwalia had to stop and wait for us, she said,
"I see you are becoming useless again. Very well, you need not try so hard. For now, I wish folk to not notice us. That is all."
"I will try."
Her beauty fell away from her. She became ordinary, and less than ordinary, not worthy of notice. Dwalia trudged through the crowds, and people grudgingly gave way to her, and we lurched along after her. I could feel Vindelire's magic failing. I glanced over at him. His power sputtered and danced like a dying flame on a damp log.
"I can't,"
he gasped, and gave up his efforts. Dwalia glared at him. I wondered if she knew he no longer cloaked her. But as we tottered along behind her, folk began to notice her. I saw a woman wince at the scar on her cheek. A little boy took his finger from his mouth and pointed it at her. His mother shushed him and hurried him along. Twice, pale folk stopped and turned toward her, as if they might greet her, but she didn't even pause for them. Folk stared at her, and she must have known they saw her as she truly was. One grey-bearded sailor gave a caw of dismay at the sight of her.
"A feather bonnet on a pig!"
he said to his swarthy companion as they passed, and both guffawed. Dwalia halted in the street. She did not look back at us as we caught up with her, but spoke over her shoulder.
"Leave it. There is nothing in that trunk that I'll ever wear again. Just leave it."
She reached up and tore free the pins that had secured her hat, threw it to the ground, and strode away. I was stunned. I'd heard tears in her voice. Vindelire dropped his end of the trunk with a thud. It took longer for me to realize she was serious. She didn't look back at us. She stumped away from us, and we were both panting when we finally caught up with her. I was quickly aware that I had not trotted or even walked much in our days aboard the ship. Her pace meant that I had little time to look around. I had only glimpses of a well-kept city with wide, uncluttered streets. The people we passed were clean, and their clothing was simple but whole. The women's skirts were wide-belted at the waist, and the loose folds came scarcely to their knees. They wore sandals, and their blouses either had no sleeves at all or sleeves like bells that fell past their wrists. They were taller than buck women, and not even the dark-haired ones had curly hair. Some of the men wore only vests over their bared chests, and their trousers were as short as the women's skirts. I supposed it made sense in that warmer climate, but to me they appeared half-naked. They were lighter skinned than six Dutchies folk, and taller, and for once my pale hair drew not a second glance. I saw not a single beggar. As we left the wharfs and warehouse and inns behind, we passed some of the pink and pale yellow buildings I had seen from the ship's deck. There were flower boxes below the windows and benches by the doors. Shutters were opened wide on this fine day, and I saw rows of spinning wheels in one pink building, the spinners hard at work, and heard the clack of looms from the shadowed room beyond them. We passed a building that breathed out warmth and the smell of baking bread. Everywhere I looked, I saw cleanliness and order. It was not at all what I had imagined Clary's would be. Given how cruel Dwalia had been, I had imagined a whole city of hateful people, not this pastel prosperity. There was other foot traffic on the road with us. As in the port part of the city, the folk hurrying along beside us were a mixed lot. Most of them were light-haired and fair-skinned, and dressed in the garb of Clary's. But some were plainly foreigners and travellers from afar. Mixed in with them were men and women in guard's garb, wearing a badge with a twining vine on it. Many of them stared openly at Dwalia's ruined face, and some appeared to recognize her, but no one offered her a greeting. Those who seemed to recognize her looked shocked or turned away. For her part, she did not offer good day to anyone, and set a pace that meant we passed most of our fellow walkers. Our path toward the White Island led us along the shoreline. Water lapped on the beach, grey and white sand sparkled over bones of granite. We walked on a smooth road past houses with vegetable gardens and arbours between them. I saw children, all dressed in the same sort of smock garments, playing in dooryards or sitting on the steps of the houses. I could not tell if they were boys or girls. Dwalia strode on. As she walked, I watched her tug the final pins from her hair and let her braids hang lank about her face. She took off her necklace and lifted the earrings from her ears. I almost thought she would toss them aside, but she tucked them into her bag. With them gone, all traces of Lady Obricia vanished. Even her fine gown became an oddity rather than lovely. To my surprise, I became aware of her feelings. She did not simmer and boil as my father had. My father's thoughts and emotions had always surged against my senses. They were why I had first learned to make walls within my mind. Dwalia's were not nearly so strong. I think I sensed them only because for so long I had pushed tendrils of my thoughts into her mind. It was, as Wolffather had warned me, a way in was also a way out. And now her thoughts seeped through to me. I felt from her a resentful anger that she had never been beautiful, and had never felt loved, only tolerated, because she was useful. I felt her heart wander back to a time when she had known love once, and loved in return. I saw a tall woman smiling down on her, the pale woman. Then, as if crushed under a fall of icicles, that feeling stopped. The closer we drew to the island, the more I sensed self-justification that was rooted in anger. She would force them to acknowledge that she had not failed. She would not allow them to mock or rebuke her. And she would have her vengeance. As if she felt the brush of my thoughts against hers, she glared back at both of us.
"Hurry up!" she snapped. "The tide is going out. I want to be there early, not caught in the crowds of petitioners. Vindelire, walk with your head up. You look like an ox going to slaughter. And you, little beech, keep your tongue still while the four are listening to me. Understand me? Not a sound from you, or I swear I'll kill you."
It was her first rebuke to me in several days, and it startled me. Vindelire did lift his head, but I think he was more encouraged by her spitting venom at me than at her order to him. Clearly I had fallen from her favor, at least back to his level. Vindelire still waddled when he walked, but he waddled faster. I dreaded the meeting with the four, and longed to ask questions about them, but kept my tongue stilled. Several times Vindelire glanced over at me, as if almost hoping I'd ask him. I didn't. A few times my secret plan tried to seep into my thoughts. I dammed it back. I was going to be happy here in Clara's. I would have a good life. I'd be useful here. When I felt Vindelire looking at me, I turned a vacuous smile on him. I wanted to laugh aloud at his startled face, but I restrained myself. We left the houses behind and walked past a very large building of white stone. There was nothing of grace about it. It was entirely functional. There was a large stable beside it, with its own smithy, and there were several open areas where sweating guardsmen were performing drills. The shouted commands of their instructor echoed from the building's side, and dust rose around the guards as they lunged, clashed, and retreated in turn. Then we entered a section of the town that reminded me more of the Winterfest booths than a true village. Sturdy stone cottages had shade awnings in front of them, and people stood in queues before them. In the shade, under the awnings, people paler than me with fluffy white hair sat in embellished chairs that were almost thrones. Some had tiny scrolls to sell. Others had the same sort of cupboard as the man who had told us to find the sea rose. Some of the sellers wore exotic scarves and sparkling earrings and vests of lace. Others were clad in plain shifts of pale yellow or rose or azure. One had a large crystal ball on a filigreed stand and was staring into it with eyes the same color as a trout's. A woman stood silently before her, clasping a young man's hand. There were other vendors there, selling charms for luck, or pregnancy, or sheep fertility, charms for good crops, or to help the baby sleep at night. These wares were cried loudly by younger versions of the merchants, who moved about the crowd carrying trays, their voices as shrill and incessant as the gulls over the harbour. There were food stalls, too, selling foods both sweet and savoury. Their tempting aromas reminded me that we had eaten at dawn and walked a fair pace since then. But Dwalia did not pause. I could have spent the whole afternoon exploring that market, but she strode through it without a pause or a glance to left or right. Once I heard a hushed whisper.
"I'm sure it's her. It's Dwalia."
Someone else said,
"But where are the others then? All the Lurics on those fine white horses?"
Not even that turned her head. We hurried past and through folk standing in a thick line, and some cursed at us and others shouted at us for being rude, but Dwalia threaded through the crowd until we came to the head of the line. A short causeway of stone and sand ended in a tall gate made of iron bars. Just beyond the gate, the causeway ended abruptly in water. Beyond that water, on a stony island, was the white stronghold. Before the gate stood four sturdy guards. Two held pikes and stood staring stonily at the queuing people. The other two wore swords. They were formidable warriors, blue-eyed, dark-haired, and well-muscled, and even the women were taller than my father. but Dwalia did not pause or hesitate.
I am going to cross.
No, you are not.
The man who spoke did not even look at her.
You are going to go back to the end of the line and wait your turn. When the tide goes out and the water has receded completely, then we will admit pilgrims in an orderly fashion, two abreast. That is how we do this.
Dwalia stepped closer and spoke through clenched teeth.
I know how we do it. I am one of the Circle. I am Lyngstrah Dwalia, and I have returned. The Four will wish to hear my report as soon as they possibly can. You should not dare to detain me.
She gave Vindelire a sideways glare. I felt him try. His thin magic lapped against the guards. One cocked his head and looked at her carefully.
Dwalia.
The guard spoke it as a name he knew. He lifted an elbow and nudged the woman next to him.
Is that her? Dwalia?
The other guard grudgingly shifted her gaze from the queue of anxious pilgrims to study Dwalia, the wrinkles in her brow growing deeper as she did so. Then her eyes fell on Vindelire.
She left here a long time ago, rode at the head of a troop of white horses and riders.
Could be her, but she looks different in that dress.
But that one, him I recognize. He is Dwalia's creature, Vindelire. He does her bidding, so if she has him, then I guess it's her. We should let her cross.
But now, while the water still runs over the causeway? It's not that deep. I can tell. I wish to cross now.
Dwalia's tone brooked no argument.
Open the gate for me.
They stepped back from her, conferred briefly. One scowled and seemed to indicate her fine dress, but the other shrugged, and he was the one who unlatched the gate and swung it open. We had to step back to allow its motion, and that crowded us into the waiting petitioners. And when the gate was clear, and Dwalia stepped forward with Vindelire and me following, the crowd moved with us, trying to cross with us. The guards with the pikes moved forward, crossing their weapons and pushing them back. We stepped forward alone. The causeway was of smooth-cut stone, flat as a table. Dwalia didn't pause when she reached the water's edge. She did not lift her skirts or take off her shoes to carry them. She walked forward as if the sea did not still own that space. We followed. The water was shallow at first, not warm, but not numbingly cold. As we went forward, it got quickly deeper, soaking my shoes and moving past my ankles to my shins. I began to feel the tug of the ebbing tide. Beside me, Vindelire was scowling.
I don't like this,
he said bitterly. Neither Dwalia nor I paid him any mind, but I soon began to share his uneasiness. The water got deeper and the pull of the receding waves stronger. I had waded in creeks and streams, but this was seawater. It had a smell and a stickiness that surprised me. The opposite gate on the far end of the sunken causeway had not looked very far away when we began. Now, as the water rose past my knees and up my thighs, the safety of the far shore seemed to retreat. Even Dwalia slowed as she sloshed forward. I fixed my eyes on her back and fought the weight of the water. The tide might be ebbing as they had said, but waves still came and went, and sometimes they wet me to my waist. Vindelire had begun to make an anxious noise, between a hum and a whine. He was falling behind. When I glanced back and realized that, I tried to move faster. The water was colder now, and I panted as I pushed my way through it. Leave him behind, I thought fiercely. I think he felt my wish, for his wail grew louder, and I heard a splash as he stumbled, and then his hoarse cry as he surged to his feet again.
Drown!
I arrowed that thought at him, and then shut myself behind my walls. The sun beat down on my head, scorching my scalp through my short hair, while the water pressed against me and drew warmth out of my feet and legs. I folded my arms high on my chest and hugged my bundled clothing to myself. I pushed my thirst to one side along with my aching muscles. Shipboard life had not prepared me for today's hike. The sunlight bounced off the water and into my eyes. I lifted my head and tried to see Dwalia, but glittering light dazzled my eyes. I began to feel shaky and ill. Was the water shallower? Perhaps. I took heart and surged on, head and shoulders bent as I fought the waves. When next I lifted my head and looked for Dwalia, she stood at the far gate, remonstrating and cursing the guards who would not open it to her. Beyond that gate, a huddle of people awaited its opening to leave the castle. Their weary stances and aprons of leather or fabric proclaimed them to be servants of the servants, probably on their way to their homes. I sloshed up behind Dwalia. She astonished me by swiveling about, seizing me by my collar, and near lifting me off my feet to shake me at the guards.
"The unexpected son!" she snarled at them. "Do you want to be the ones who delayed his arrival before the four?"
The guards exchanged glances. The taller man looked back at her.
"That old myth!"
Vindelire came shuddering up beside us. One guard nudged the other.
"That's Vindelire. No mistaking that treacherous little gelding. So she is Dwalia. Let them in."
Dwalia did not release her grip on my collar as the gate opened and we passed through. I tried not to resist her pulling, but it meant walking on my tiptoes. I could not look back to see Vindelire following, but I heard the thud of the barred gate as it shut behind us. A road of dun sand stretched before us. The sun wore sparkles in it. It was straight and featureless. To either side of it, a barren and rocky landscape spread. It was so flat and empty that I knew that the hands of men had shaped it. Nothing could cross this expanse of ground and not be seen. Never had I seen an area so devoid of small life. The only relief to the eye were occasional stones, and none of them was larger than a bushel basket. Dwalia suddenly released me.
"Don't dawdle, and don't speak," she ordered me,
and then set off at her distance-eating stride again. Her once fine skirts were wet and slapped against her legs as she walked. I followed, trying to match her pace. When I lifted my eyes to stare at our destination, it dazzled me more than the sunlight on the water. The white walls of the castle glittered. We walked and walked, and seemed to come no closer. Gradually, I began to realize that I had greatly underestimated how large a fortress it was, or castle, or palace. From the ship I had seen 8 towers. This close to it, when I looked up, I saw only 2, and the misshapen heads that topped them looked like skulls. I slogged along, head lowered as the sun pounded down on us, eyes half closed against the brightness. Every time I lifted my head, the aspect of the immense structure at the end of the long road seemed to have changed. When we were close enough that I had to crane my neck back to see the tops of the towers, the ornate bas-reliefs on the outside of the walls became evident. They were the only marks I could see on the smooth white walls. From this vantage, I saw no windows, not even arrow slits, and no doors. On this side of the castle, there was no access at all, yet the road led directly to it. White on white, the etched carvings were many times taller than a man, and glittering even brighter than the walls they graced. I stared for a moment, and then had to look away and close my eyes. But when I shut my eyes, there the carvings were again, inside my eyelids, like a climbing white vine. I recognized it. Impossibly, I knew what it was. I remembered it from a life I had never lived, or perhaps from a future I had yet to see. That vine had crawled through my dreams. I'd drawn it on the front page of my journal to frame my name. I'd given it leaves and trumpet flowers. I'd been wrong. It was an abstract representation, and there was a thought I'd never had before, that an artist could create a picture of an idea, and I would know what it was. I recognized it as the river of all possible times, cascading down from the present and splitting into 1,000, no, 1,000,000, no, an infinite number of possible futures, and every one of those splintered into another infinity of possible futures. And among them all, a single gleaming thread, incredibly narrow, that represented the future as it could, should, and ought to be. If events were guided correctly, if the white prophet dreamed and believed and ventured forth to put the world on that path, time would follow it. I opened my eyes again, for I had only closed them a moment. There it was again, before me, and despite all I had come through, all I had endured to come here, and how much I hated the people who had brought me here, I suddenly felt a lift of belonging. I was here, at last. A certainty rose in me, clearer than anything I had ever known about myself. I was supposed to be here, in this place, and in this time. This was where I was supposed to be. A dozen dreams I had had suddenly spun and then interlocked with more recent dreams inside me. The vague plan was no longer vague. I'd felt a similar surge of certainty on the day I had freed my tongue. I'd seen the paths with such clarity only once before in my life, on that fateful day in winter when the beggar had touched me and I'd seen how all futures began at my feet. Oh, the great good that I could do, now that I was here. My fate was here, and only I could shape it. It stole my breath away, and as I gazed, I felt my heart lift, just as the minstrels described it could happen. I was here, and the great work of my life was before me. I realized I had stopped only when Vindelire trudged past me. He looked at me with a gaze full of venom, and I found I could not care. A smile pulled at my mouth. Walls up.
B, hurry up!
Dwalia snapped the command over her shoulder.
Coming,
I replied, and something in my tone made her halt and look back at me. I cast my eyes down and bowed my head. This was not a thing to share with anyone. I needed to hold it close inside me. The knowledge was like a glittering stone scooped from a filthy puddle. I saw the shine of it, but I knew that the more I handled it, the cleaner and clearer it would become. And like a jewel, if I revealed it, thieves would take it from me in any way they could. I heard a sound behind us and looked back. The tide was out, and the causeway stood above the water. A snake of people, 6 or 8 wide, now packed the narrow belt of road that ran between the waters. Some were almost across, but even after they reached the island and the waters of the bay no longer hedged them in, they did not spread out, but kept to the narrow causeway.
Hurry!
Dwalia urged me again. No wonder she kept us to such a rapid pace. If we did not keep up our speed, they would overtake us, maybe even trample us. Ahead, where there had been only smooth wall, cracks appeared, startling black against the white. The cracks became the edges of the doors, and then they opened wide. A phalanx of guards, clad in gleaming silver armor and pale yellow cloaks, marched out and formed up in 2 rows alongside our path. I thought they would halt us, but Dwalia glared at them and made a sign with her hand, and we strode past without a word. It was not until we had passed under the arch of the entry and emerged into a courtyard that a man stepped in front of us. He was tall and thin and wore a sword, but even in his armor he looked skinny and weak. His face was pasty and blemished, with splotches of pink, peeling skin. Tufts of graying hair stuck out the sides of his helmet. He narrowed his eyes.
Lyngstraw Dwalia!
He made her name an accusation.
You left here with a mounted guard of Lurics. Where are they and their fine steeds? Why do you return alone?
Step aside, Boss Fodi. There is no time to waste. I must have audience with Symph and Felody immediately.
He held his place a moment longer, his gaze wandering over her damaged face, inspecting Vindelire's ragged garments, and then settling on me. His frown became a grimace of disapproval. Then he stepped aside and made a grand gesture for us to pass him.
Go as you will, Dwalia. Were I coming back from a doubtful quest, scarred and stripped of all that had been entrusted to me, I doubt I'd be in such a hurry to report my failure to the fore.
I didn't fail,
she replied tersely. As we hurried past him, he muttered,
Of all the ones to come back alive, it had to be Vindelire.
I heard him spit. The wide courtyard was paved in patterns of white and black stone and was as clean as if it had been recently swept. Lining the inner walls of the outer keep were food and drink stalls, alongside bright carts with multiple drawers that would, I now knew, hold fortune papers inside nutshells. Pennants and garlands hung nearly motionless in the heat. Open-sided pavilions shaded tables and benches that awaited hungry and thirsty patrons. It looked like a celebration, far larger than Winterfest at Oaksby Water. For one instant, childish curiosity made me forget who I was now, and I longed to wander among the booths and buy sweets and bright gewgaws.
"Hurry up, stupid!"
Dwalia barked. These joys were not for Vindelire or me. I walked away from the child I had been. She hurried us toward the finest structure within the fortress walls. It was built, apparently, of white ivory. The doors and windows were a filigree wrought in bone or stone. This stronghouse was the base for the four slender onion-bud towers I had glimpsed from the ship. It looked impossible for such towers to be so tall and support such pinnacles. But there they were.
"Come!"
Dwalia snapped at me, and for the first time in some days, she slapped my face. I felt the old split at the corner of my mouth bleed again. I lifted a hand to press it closed and followed her. Double doors stood open beyond a columned portico. We ascended wide steps to reach them. The cessation of sunlight beating down on my head and shoulders was a shock. My shoes were still damp. I tracked grit from the wet causeway onto the immaculate floor. As my eyes adjusted to the light, I became aware of the magnificence that surrounded me. Here, the doorways were edged with gilt, or perhaps real gold. Brilliant paintings in opulent frames, the subjects many times larger than life, graced every wall. Tasseled tapestries hung on the upper walls. I had never seen white wood, but every wall in here was panelled in it. I lifted my eyes to see that even the high ceilings were painted with incomprehensible landscapes. I felt very small and out of place in such grandeur. But Dwalia was uncowed by any of it. The woman who blocked our way was robed in fabric of rich yellow, yellower than dandelions. Her sleeves hung slightly past her wrists, and her full skirts brushed the floor. The collar stood up to her chin, and her flowered headdress left only the circle of her pale face showing. The red of her painted mouth was shocking.
"Dwalia,"
she said, and waited, scowling. In the distance, I heard a door open and then shut. Two people walked past us and out of the door. As they exited to the pavilion outside, a roar of voices reached my ears. The crowd had reached the outer courtyard. Then the closing door cut off their sounds. Dwalia spoke.
"I must have an audience with Simph and Felody immediately."
The woman smiled nastily.
"This is not a day for private audiences. The four are in the judgment chamber, prepared to hear grievances and assign blame and penalties. You must know those appointments are made months in advance." "But..."
She smiled like a snarling cat.
"Perhaps I can manage to get you an appointment."
At those words, Vindelire's hands flew to his cheeks and then covered his mouth.
"No. I wish to see Simph, alone or with Felody, only those two, at once, Denise."
Dwalia gave Vindelire a glare. He dropped his hands and then hunched his shoulders as if expecting a blow. The woman in yellow folded her lips, leaving her face all but featureless, for her eyes were grey, and as I stared at her, I realized that she had no eyebrows.
"It can't be done today. Perhaps the day after tomorrow I can..."
"If you make my news wait 2 days, I think the four will slowly remove your skin. Or perhaps allow me to perform that task myself."
I had thought Denise was as pale as she could get, but her face turned as white as my father's good paper.
"I will convey your request to their attendants."
"See that you do,"
Dwalia interrupted.
We will await their summons in the Joy Chamber. See that refreshments are brought to us promptly. We have come a long way.
You do not command me, the woman said, but Dwalia only snorted.
Follow,
she ordered Vindelire and me, and led us from the circular entry hall down one of the corridors, branching off it like the spokes of a wheel. We walked on spotless white stone past disapproving portraits. Behind us, I heard the outer doors open and looked back to see Denise greeting a procession of finely dressed folk. Dwalia moved down the hall with great familiarity. When we came to a door adorned with brass insets of multiple suns, she pushed it open and we followed her in. I trailed curious fingers on the door as I passed it. It looked as if it had been made of large panels of bone or ivory, but what creature would have bones or tusks that large?
Shut the door,
Dwalia snapped, and I snatched my hand back from the panel. Vindelire was behind me, and he pushed it closed. How long had it been since I'd stood still inside a room that didn't shift with the waves? I took a deep breath and looked around me. It was a room designed for waiting and discomfort. Two milky white windows admitted filtered light, but no view. Chairs of hardwood with straight backs lined the walls. A bare table of white wood sat in the center of the room. There was no cloth on it, no vessel of flowers such as my mother would have placed. The floor was hard white stone, and the walls were featureless white wood panels. Massive white beams crossed the ceiling overhead. With the door closed, no sound came from outside. Dwalia saw me looking around.
Go and sit down, she instructed me.
I was extremely thirsty, and I needed to pee, but I knew there would be no opportunity to appease either need. I went to one of the chairs and sat. It was too tall, and my feet dangled. Uncomfortable. I tucked my small pack of bundled clothes behind me. It didn't help. Dwalia did not sit. She walked slowly around the room like a rat traveling the walls. Vindelire shuffled along behind her until she abruptly spun about and slapped him.
Stop that!
He caught his breath on a sob, glared at me, and then took the chair farthest away. He sat on the edge of it, his toes on the floor and his heels jiggling soundlessly. She pointed her finger at him.
Nothing left? You have no power left at all?
His lower lip trembled.
You well know it has seldom worked against those with a strong measure of white blood. I could not sway Denise. Besides, I had used so much for you on the captain and crew. It was a lot of work.
Be quiet.
She opened the top buttons of her blouse and fished in her bosom. She pulled out the leather pouch, and Vindelire's eyes lit as she took the glass tube from it.
It is fortunate I saved some. You must convince the four to listen to me, and believe me.
His face crumpled.
All four? It would be hard. It would be hard even if I had a full dose. Coltrane. I might be able to sway Coltrane, but...
Be quiet!
She had unstoppered the tube, but when she tipped it, the coagulated mess in the bottom didn't shift. She pushed the stopper back in and shook the tube. The clog in the bottom didn't move.
We are damned, she said.
She opened the tube and thrust a finger in. It was too short to reach the clot in the bottom. She could not touch the residue. She shoved it at Vindelire.
Spit in it, then mix it and drink it.
I watched as he drooled saliva down the tube and then tipped the tube to try to mix it. I felt my gorge rise and looked away.
It's not working,
he wailed.
Break the tube,
she ordered him. He tried. He tapped it on the floor. Nothing happened. He tried again, harder and harder, until suddenly it shattered. The serpent slime was a dried-up wad. Vindelire picked it up, and, heedless of the glass splinters that clung to it, put it in his mouth. Dwalia waited, staring at him. He breathed out hard through his nose. When he spoke, blood flecked his lips.
Nothing,
he wailed.
Nothing at all.
The blow Dwalia dealt him snapped his head on his neck and he fell to the floor. He sprawled there, his breath faltering in and out. She walked away from him and sat down in one of the chairs. She did not utter a word. Eventually, Vindelire got to his knees and crawled to a chair not far from mine. He pulled himself up and sat in it like a pile of soiled laundry. No one spoke. We waited. No one brought the refreshments Dwalia had demanded. We waited and waited. The late afternoon sun struck our obscured windows, making a rectangle of soupy light on the featureless floor. The door opened. Denise, the same woman who had admitted us, appeared.
You will be seen in the judgment chamber. Now.
The judgment chamber! That is not what I told you I wanted!
Denise turned and walked away without waiting for us to follow. Dwalia motioned me sharply to her side and seized my shoulder in a hard grip.
Say nothing,
she reminded me. She pushed me along in front of her. The pace she set did not allow me to glance back. We followed Denise back to the entry chamber and then down a different corridor. This one was broader and more elegant, and we walked a much longer distance, my bladder aching at every step. At the very end of the corridor stood two doors with four shining symbols embedded in them. Even in the muted light of the hall, the symbols gleamed. Perhaps they meant something, but to me they were just shapes in blue, green, yellow, and red. Denise pushed a brass handle, and the doors swung wide. The room was brightly lit, white sunlight streaming in from four openings in the ceiling, and I blinked at the sudden brilliance. Dwalia pushed me past and through spectators, who stood motionless and silent. I stumbled forward over the polished white floor. When she halted me, I lifted my eyes to behold an elevated dais with four thrones of carved ivory upon it. One throne sparkled with rubies, another with emeralds. I did not know what jewels were so yellow and blue on the other two. Could there be that many jewels in the world? For a moment, that question distracted me from the occupants of the chairs. Two men, two women. One woman was young and beautiful, with pale skin and hair of white gold. Her lips had been painted red, and her brows and lashes were lined in black. It was a startling beauty rather than a comfortable one. Her pale arms were bare, and her torso encased in red silk so tautly tailored to her that she might have been naked and merely painted red. Her full skirt was black and reached to her knees. Scarlet sandals framed her feet, the laces crossing and recrossing her calves. I thought her clothing looked painful to wear. The woman who sat next to her was very grand. Her cascading hair was white and unbound and straight. Her eyes were a very faded blue, and her lips were the pink of an old rose. She was dressed in a pale blue robe that was as simple as the other woman's scarlet garments were complicated. The pearls that roped her throat and dangled in strings from her ears and wrapped her wrists were all of a size and gleamed warmly. The men flanked the women, one at each end of the arc. One was painted like a puppet, his skin white and his hair molded to his scalp with white powder. His eyes were dark, those he could not disguise. His jerkin and leggings were dark green, and the rich cloak he wore was the green of spring ferns. His dark gaze was distant and thoughtful. At the other end of the arc was a portly man. He was pale, his hair more white than yellow, but his clothes were all gloriously yellow. Buttercups and dandelions and daffodils could not rival all the shades of yellow in his garments. His hands rested on top of his belly, and each finger was graced with a ring of gold or silver, even his thumbs. Thick hoops of yellow gold hung from his ears, and a flat golden throat piece began under his chin and spread in plaits over his collarbones. I stared at them in puzzlement. The gaudy thrones and their elaborate separation of colors made them seem almost comical. To either side of the dais, two very large guards held spears. They stared impassively at the gathered people. I realized the green man was glaring at me. At the same instant, the pressure of Dwalia's hand on my shoulder drove me crookedly down. I fell to one knee and then got my other leg under me. I glanced to one side and saw that Vindelire was already kneeling. Past him, I saw a row of pale folk lining the wall. Their garments were loose tunics and trousers in light hues. Hair that was barely blonde, eyes nearly colourless, like the butterfly messenger my father and I had burned. Dwalia remained in a deep bow until one of the women on the dais spoke. I heard her years in her voice. She sounded disgusted.
"Straighten up, Lyngstrad Dwalia. Your bow is more insult than respect. You have returned after sending us no word for many months. Fitting that you come to us in the judgment chamber. Where are those we sent out with you? Lurix and Steeds gone? Stand straight and explain yourself."
My hair hung over my brow and down into my eyes. I peered through it as Dwalia spoke.
"Honored ones, may I tell you my tale from the beginning? For it is a long and complicated path I have trodden. There have been losses, grievous losses, but those lives were not wasted, but surrendered to buy us exactly what you sent me to find. I bring to you the unexpected son."
She seized the back of my collar, and I was jerked upright, as when someone lifts a pup by the scruff of his neck. I stared at the four in surprise. Their expressions were startling. The red